Iran strongly denies baseless allegations by the U.S. and the U.K. accusing Tehran of being behind a July cyber attack against Albania. Israeli forces fatally shoot another Palestinian youth in a raid on a village near the city of Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. And defying international outcry, Israel's prime minister rejects the possibility of prosecuting a soldier who fatally shot Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to World News. In our top story, Iran has vehemently denied baseless allegations by the U.S. and the U.K., accusing Tehran of masterminding a cyber attack against Albania. Foreign Ministry spokesperson Nasser Kanani said the U.S. and U.K. are not in a position to level such accusations against Iran. He added both countries have in the past supported numerous cyber attacks against Iran's infrastructure and even its nuclear facilities. Kanani said Iran is ready to give a powerful response to any political adventurism against the country on basis of such false allegations. Earlier on Wednesday, Albania announced the cutting of ties with Tehran, giving Iranian diplomats 24 hours to leave the country. Tehran claims Tehran was behind a July cyber attack. The White House then warned of further action against Iran. The new British Foreign Secretary also blamed Iran for the cyber attack against the Albanian government. Iran says unilateral promises by countries about stopping nuclear tests cannot replace nuclear disarmament unless they turn into legally binding obligations. Iran's deputy ambassador to the UN, Zahra Ershadi, made the remark while addressing a UN meeting on nuclear disarmament. She noted 26 years after the extension of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT, the world is still awaiting a halt to nuclear tests. Ershadi added, Iran regrets the delay in halting nuclear testing and considers it a major reason for the failure of the 10th NPT review conference. She said Iran believes that immediate nuclear disarmament is the best way to save the world from the risks posed by nuclear weapons. Ershadi said the same approach must be taken to Israel's arsenal of weapons of mass destruction, which threatens security and stability of West Asia. Iran's top general has warned against growing military cooperation between the U.S. and Israel in the Persian Gulf and the negative consequences for regional countries. During our news review program, we discuss this issue in length with our guests. Here it is.
Iran's top general warns of ramifications of the growing military partnership between the U.S. and the Israeli regime in the Persian Gulf region. Major General Mohammad Bagheri says the U.S. military has tried to make up for the withdrawal of its warships from the region by connecting the, quote, child-killer Israeli military to the U.S. Central Command. He said the cooperation will provide the Israeli regime with America's spying facilities. The chairman of the Chiefs of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces noted that the partnership will increase threats to Iran. Bagheri, however, has warned regional countries hosting American and Israeli forces against any threat to Iran's security. He underlined that the Islamic Republic has always urged its neighbors not to rely on foreigners for regional security. Sayyid Mostafa Khoshesh is a political commentator who joins us from Tehran. We also have Don Dabar, a radio host, journalist, and political activist, joining us from New York. Welcome to you both. So tell us exactly this configuration that Israel and the U.S. have concocted here. Is it correct to conclude that Israel, through CENTCOM, which obviously is American-run, of which there are U.S. military bases in countries in the region, will now be able to militarily execute what it wants based on the bases that it has in these various countries, which are the Persian Gulf Arab countries, which hence maybe explains why U.S. and Israel are so keen on this so-called normalization between these countries?
Well, I think it's a reflection that, you know, the fact that this is becoming more and more an integrated command, you know, essentially the so-called IDF, being partnering, quote unquote, with CENTCOM, which is the Central Command of the U.S. military, is a reflection of the condition of hostilities at this point that actually constitute a war with multiple fronts. You have a front on Russia's border with Ukraine. You have a front in Syria with the U.S. occupation there and, you know, regular Israeli raids. You have a front in Yemen. You have a front still smoldering in Iraq. Just the entire area is in a state of war. And as the war becomes more and more actualized, you're going to see a more and more obvious or public viewing of the integration of command in these, you know, in these areas. So it's not a surprise that we're seeing this. You look at Albania, what's happening there. You're looking at the situation with the various types of computers, whatever you call the electronic espionage and attacks and warfare, and the ongoing media battle where Iran's media has been frozen out of the international. You can't broadcast in these large pieces of territory. It's clear that there's a war that's ongoing. We're not falling into one. We're in one. And the fact that we see an integrated command now in front of us shouldn't surprise anyone. I don't really think it's a change of anything other than visibility.
Mm-hmm. Well, Seyed Mostafa Khoshesh, how do you see this? I mean, Iran obviously it does not like it. I'm curious whether it's Israel now part of CENTCOM in a sense or operating through CENTCOM, which I'm guessing has, as I asked Don DeBar, that the U.S. has these military bases in regional countries, and therefore perhaps there was a push for normalization of ties. Maybe this is part of the reason.
Hello, and thanks for having me. That's true, exactly. The United States is on decline, and it means to create a World War II-like situation and environment in the whole world. So it has started some kind of proxy warfare against the Russians at the cost of the Europeans. Also, they have escalated tensions in the Taiwan Strait and escalated tensions against China at the cost of Taiwan. And they plan to do the same now that the JCPOA talks has entered another phase, another statement, and another phase of war willpower. They have escalated tensions against Iran under the same pattern. Some might believe that that the United States, because it's decreasing forces and redeploying to the South China Sea, and it doesn't want to leave its Arab allies in the region, disappointed. So they have started some kind of reconnaissance mission in the Strait, in the Strait of Hormuz, through this, sea drones, to collect information to help them and to reduce numbers of forces and regional, bases, but to make use of electronics and, semi-automatic, robotic things and by just advancing advanced technology. But this is not the case. Intel shows that they mean to spy on the Iranians in the patrolling the region in order to find suitable route to spread Israeli warships and also submarines into the Persian Gulf. This is not going to be tolerated by Iran, as has been warned repeatedly by chief Iranian officials and army commanders. One of the tactics used by the United States is that they, once they are redeploying to the South China Sea, they mean to start a coalition, Arab-Israeli coalition, to be aided and assisted by the NATO allies in the Persian Gulf, and to replace themselves with them in order to slow down Iran's regional growth in their absence. So initially it started under Donald Trump in the last 1 or 2 years after normalization of ties in the last couple of years of his presidency. But they failed. As soon as the Israeli submarines and warships meant to leave the Red Sea and through the Bab el-Mandeb, the Iranian army sent flotillas to confront them. At least two confrontations happened, and the Israelis moved back. Then they started the war games with their Arab allies, Israeli war games, some 20 countries or more who are present and participated in that. And then now they're thinking of how to spread to the Arab Sea from the Red Sea, then to the Sea of Oman and the Persian Gulf, and they are spying on Iranian forces. And let's remember that Iran has the lengthiest coastline, and it's officially internationally in charge of the Strait of Hormuz that happens to be on the Iranian side, actually. And it's in charge of managing and controlling safe shipping in the region. And the United States or others should receive permission from the Iranians. That has been the case always. It means that they are only allowed to have safe passage through the strait. And they cannot impose or meddle with the management of this strait. Okay. That's what they are trying to do.
Thank you for that. Say Mustafa Khoshesh, political commentator, Don DeBar, pleasure, radio host, journalist, and political activist from New York. And with that, we come to an end for this news interview. Thanks for tuning in.
Israel's deadly violence against Palestinians shows no sign of abating. Latest victim is a youth fatally shot by Israeli forces near the West Bank city of Ramallah. Now, according to local sources, the new fatality came after Israeli forces opened fire on Palestinians during a raid on a village in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli army says he was hit after attacking a regime soldier. Israel has stepped up deadly raids, though, across Palestinian territories in recent months. According to a Palestinian rights group, Israel has killed more than 110 people in the West Bank and Gaza Strip since the beginning of 2022. And apparently Israel will not prosecute a soldier who possibly shot dead veteran Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh back in May. That's according to the regime's prime minister. Yair Lapid said Israeli soldiers have the full backing of the regime. Comments came 2 days after the Israeli army admitted in a report that there's a high possibility that Abu Akleh was accidentally shot by a regime soldier. The Palestinian Authority and Abu Akleh's family have denounced the report, describing it as an attempt by Israel to evade responsibility for her murder. The veteran reporter was wearing a bulletproof vest marked press and a helmet when she was shot in the head during an Israeli army raid in the Jenin refugee camp. Russian natural gas deliveries to EU members have dropped by 48% so far this year. That's according to Russian energy giant Gazprom. The energy corporation said the decline totals almost 50% if you add the UK. Gazprom had announced Friday the Nord Stream 1 pipeline will remain halted due to a leak. It said the pipeline will not resume until it's totally repaired. Nord Stream 1 is the single biggest pipeline for Russian gas deliveries to Europe and has the capacity to provide the continent with 55 billion cubic meters of gas annually. But Russia and the European Union are on a collision course over gas supplies. EU is mulling to impose a price cap on Russian gas. President Vladimir Putin, though, has warned of halting all oil and gas in case that cap is imposed.
We will not supply anything at all if it is contrary to our interests, in this case, economic interests. We will not supply gas, oil, coal, or fuel oil. We will fulfill our contractual obligations in full.
Hours after Putin's warning, a European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said Bloc will propose a price cap on Russian gas. She said the move will lower the cost of gas and enable EU members to support the most vulnerable of households and companies. Proposal first came from the Group of Seven Developed Countries, or the G7, and is set to be discussed during an EU meeting on energy crisis this Friday. But the bloc is still split on the price cap plan, with the Czech Republic being among members that are against the move. Newly appointed British Prime Minister Liz Truss faces grilling from the opposition Labour Party during the first session of Parliament after taking over for Labour leadership. Truss sparred with Labour leader Keir Starmer on the country's energy and cost of living crises. Truss said her cabinet will make sure new energy plan supports businesses and people. She also pledged to use more domestic oil, gas, and nuclear energy to deal with the current crisis. Premier said her cabinet needs to address energy costs for businesses, adding she is against imposing a windfall tax on energy companies to help tackle the price hike.
It's been dubbed the most right-wing cabinet for a generation. Formed after new PM Liz Truss's fulsome support for her predecessor and a purge of defeated rival Rishi Sunak loyalists. Some of the familiar faces, Kwasi Kwarteng, a free marketeer and Truss's ideological soulmate, confirmed as chancellor. Ex-leadership candidate Suelos Braverman, admired by the right-wing for attacks on, quote, woke politics, appointed home secretary. Staunch ally James Cleverly, promoted as foreign minister. On his entree, Ukraine and fixing relations with the EU, strained after Brexit, among other things. Close friend Teresa Coffey will be deputy prime minister and health secretary. The National Health Service is reeling under a staff and cash crisis. And another carryover from the Johnson administration, Jacob Rees-Mogg, the man who blamed the energy crisis in the UK on climate alarmists, will be business and energy secretary.
What we therefore have is a very clearly defined agenda with Liz Truss surrounding herself by people she thinks will be loyal to her and will share some quite central policy objectives, which I'd suggest are sharper than those of her predecessor.
The makeup of the Truss team goes against her pledge to use what she called all the fantastic talents of the Conservative Party.
Liz Truss won less than 60% of the Conservative Party membership vote, and when she threw her hat in the ring for party leadership, she won fewer than a third of the Conservative MPs' votes, which means that she could have done herself a favor by trying to appeal to as wide a base of parliamentary support as possible.
Especially because she will need her party's support for her plans for her three priorities, the economy, energy, and the NHS.
So they might grumble in private, but they'll show the impression of unity in public. The biggest issue, though, for her is that if she does controversial things in legislative terms, which MPs think aren't going to work, then she could have problems.
The 56th UK Prime Minister takes up the reins of power as the UK toils under spiraling levels of inflation, skyrocketing energy costs, an economy almost certainly in recession, and public services on the brink. It remains to be seen if she and her cabinet can deliver on her promises. Saeed Bourizza, London.
Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
New British Prime Minister Liz Truss enters 10 Downing Street in conditions that the country is grappling with economic, energy, foreign policy and NHS crises. Whether or not she could deal with the messy situation in Britain during her tenure is the main question asked by her critics and observers these days. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media to know more about the views and attitudes of this issue. This is the first part of the article. The British Daily Guardian had this headline saying Britain needs an economic strategy, instead we have got Liz Truss. Guardian wrote, as we wrestle with the disaster of Brexit and loss of the single market, our next PM is ruining Anglo-French relations. William Keegan, the writer of this article, wrote, here we are, and the question is, where do we go from here? Truss has not shared her strategic economic plans with us because she probably hasn't any. And God help us, it is down to the egregious Alexander Boris Johnson, who sacked all the sensible Remainer and Rejoiner members of his cabinet, that we are left with this bunch. Guardian, in another article penned by Gabby Hinsliff, wrote, Liz Truss takes office with a screeching handbrake turn on her flagship policy. How can anybody ever trust her judgment now? It should have been Liz Truss's moment of triumph, her chance to bask in the glory of a whooping crowd. Gone was the bouncy, perhaps only now does she feel the weight of what lies ahead. When loyal Tories struggle for nice things to say about Boris Johnson, they often fall back on claiming that at least he got the big calls right. That cliché may be hard to square with the chaotic reality of his time in office, but they reach for it because the absolute minimum expected of a prime minister is that they inspire confidence in a crisis. She won't put it that way, obviously, when she addresses the nation, but however valiantly she now tries to rewrite history, the fact remains that she horribly misjudged the cost of living emergency at first, insisting it could be handled merely with tax cuts and scrapping the green levy on fuel bills. It remains unclear how Truss would pay for a massive bailout on top of the promised tax cuts, from which she cannot retreat without triggering mutiny within her party. And also the website of the Responsible Statecraft had this headline saying there is a good chance Liz Truss's Ukraine and China policy will be worse. Responsible Statecraft wrote, no matter who is in the role, the Brits will continue to follow Washington anywhere. Johnson and Truss are, of course, conservatives, but British participation in the disastrous US invasion of Iraq was ordered by a Labour Prime Minister, Tony Blair, recently knighted at the request of the present Labour leader, Keir Starmer, a strong Blairite. British support for the US plan to expand NATO to Georgia and Ukraine was likewise initiated by the government of NRA Labour Prime Minister Gordon Brown. The roots of British attachment to the United States are very deep and spread very wide, and this attachment has only grown stronger in the recent years, even as U.S. indifference to British interests and views has grown. In the present special relationship, it is most definitely Britain that agrees to order the lobster whether it likes it or not. Common language formed much of the original basis for the close relationship. as expressed most vividly in the English-speaking Union founded by Winston Churchill, Rayard Kipling, Arthur Conan Doyle, and others as part of an effort to lay the cultural foundation for American support of the British Empire. The importance of this factor has diminished somewhat since the elites of much of the world now speak English. By the same token, however, a British upper class that used to speak good French and Latin is now virtually monoglot. Of much greater importance was the Second World War, when America saved Britain from defeat and tens of thousands of American servicemen died while based in Britain. This military relationship then became permanently institutionalized as a result of the Cold War and British membership of NATO. At the same, Harold Wilson refused, like other NATO members, to send troops to Vietnam despite fervent appeals by the Johnson administration, and Margaret Thatcher did not dream of asking U.S. permission before sending a British expeditionary force to reconquer the Falklands. British critics of the relationship today sometimes say that Britain is in America's pocket or some less mentionable position, but the truth is rather that Britain rides around on America's shoulders. In other words, the British establishment has a deeply ingrained belief derived from the British Empire that Britain must play the role of a power on the world stage. And for many years now, this role has been entirely dependent on support from the U.S. regime. Even when Britain plays a limited part in a U.S.-led operation, in Basra Helmand or Libyan intervention, American forces end up having to bail Britain out. In this regard, responsible statecraft continued the British obsession with great power status, as it led to a role for the armed forces in the British imagination and public life for greater than in any other West European country, with the possible exception of France. Meanwhile, the armed forces, even when they sneer at Americans behind their backs, are utterly devoted to the American alliance. In two areas in particular, U.S. support is crucial. The British nukes is overwhelmingly dependent on U.S. technology. British intelligence benefits from, but also contributes to, America's Five Eyes program, described as the intelligence alliance of the Anglosphere, from which all non-English-speaking NATO members are excluded. Among more concrete benefits, this allows British officials to show off their superior knowledge in front of their less privileged European allies. A large part of the British media is now controlled from America through the Murdoch Empire, and Murdoch has shown his power to break British politicians who seriously threaten his power or the American alliance. And the Israeli lobby in Britain is likewise categorically dedicated to this alliance. The City of London and Wall Street are organically linked, with time spent working in New York, an important stage in the circus honorum of British bankers. Leading British think tanks are also now organically joined to America. One even has an American name, the Henry Jackson Society, and is explicitly dedicated to a U.S.-derived neoconservative agenda. The specifically conservative dependence on the U.S. regime has received a tremendous boost in recent years from Brexit.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. and I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. A very warm welcome to Muslim Lady. This is IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Zainab. I have with me Siddiqa. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
A very warm welcome, Siddiqa.
Thank you so much. And as usual, it's an absolute pleasure to be here once again.
Same here. The listener, Siddiqa, is a student of jurisprudence and she does an extensive research in the field of issues related to women. We discussed miscarriage with her and other many issues that were related to women. Now, a similar issue we're going to discuss today is abortion. So, starting with same, Siddiqa, what is abortion?
Okay, so abortion, the general view in the public today is the termination of an unwanted pregnancy. Unwanted, it could be for many reasons. It could be either the woman just does not want it or it poses harm for the woman to continue with the pregnancy. That is just the general understanding of abortion that exists around the world today.
Okay.
But then the need to discuss this topic at this time is specifically because of a court case that was overruled in America that has sparked debate across the world.
Yeah,
the Roe versus
protests
Wade.
Protests and riots at some places.
Exactly. So because this has sparked a new debate on abortion and the fact that abortion is not alien to the Muslim community, we need to be aware of what abortion is, what the rights of women are. Are they allowed to abort? Is there absolute abortion for women in Islam? And in general, what does Islam say about abortion? Given that it is such an important part, pregnancy is such an important part of a woman's life, Islam certainly has its views on it. And discussing it would allow women to take much more informed choices in line with their responsibility in this religion. Now, in this program, when we're discussing abortion or how I want to define it within the
framework of Islam.
Yes, within the framework of Islam, is that first, a lot of the times when people talk about abortion, it is just an absolute right to terminate a pregnancy. But within Islam, that right is not absolute. So if there's a viable, safe, healthy fetus that has the ability to become a human being and there is no threat either to the mother or the child, here abortion is not allowed.
Okay.
Right? But if there are certain cases, like for example, an ectopic pregnancy. In America, an ectopic pregnancy cannot be terminated because it comes under abortion. But Islam doesn't see an ectopic pregnancy as abortion. Ectopic pregnancy is an unviable pregnancy. Therefore, it does not fall within the borders of abortion.
Okay.
So an ectopic pregnancy is just taking out a fetus that has no viability anymore to it.
Oh.
Similarly, if there's a fetus now that is very badly deformed or does not have the ability to form into a proper human being, now some scholars, some of the jurists would say before the soul is put into the body, then there is scope for abortion. But again, what we're really discussing is within the framework of a viable, safe, healthy, with no consequences pregnancy. And just because the mother does not want it, does not mean
you're allowed to do it.
Exactly.
Okay. So it means that at some places you're even allowed and at some places you're not allowed. We'll discuss more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio. So yes, Sadiqa, you were discussing where abortion is allowed in Islam and where it is not.
Like we said, when there's a safe, viable pregnancy, abortion would not be allowed. Given that a pregnancy occurs when two consensual adults go for a relationship. Given that they've consented to having a relationship, the consequences of that cannot be aborted just on the basis of I do not want it or I cannot deal with it. Because we are talking about independent identity. Now, Islam views a fetus as an independent identity. Just because the baby would stay in the womb of the mother for 9 months does not make it absolutely dependent. There is only a short span of time where the child is dependent on the mother.
All right.
But today we also see that you have the concept of artificial wombs, which in itself is evidence that the child is an independent entity, an independent identity, and every independent identity in Islam has given rights to itself.
Yeah.
Now, when it comes to a baby, which is even in the womb of the mother, we see Islam giving that baby rights, and we see it in the concept of wills.
Yeah.
Let's say a mother is pregnant when her husband dies.
All right.
Even if the child is just 4 weeks old or 5 weeks old, inheritance would be placed aside for the child because that child already has its rights.
To the previous husband, yeah.
Exactly, because Islam views it as an independent person. Abortion of a viable, safe pregnancy is not looked favorably upon in Islam. Is the fact that a human being is a respected being in Islam. Human being is given, even when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala talks about the human in the Quran, he talks about وَنَفَقْتُ فِيهِ مِنْ رُوحِي. We blew into him our spirit.
Yes.
This is the sacredness of that human.
Yeah.
Or
That's why he's called as Ashraful Makhlukat.
Exactly. Even the Quran, again, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when he talks about the creation, he talks Wallahu Ahsanul Khaliqin.
Yes.
That is, after Allah created human, he referred to himself as the best of creators.
Ahsanul Khaliqin, the best of the creators.
This shows that the sacredness of a human being. And because that fetus has the viability of becoming a human being, at the span of around 4 or 5 months, when the spirit is blown into the body, then that's it. Islam views it as a human.
Okay.
Right? But because that 4 or 5 week fetus has the ability to become a fully grown human being and has the ability to reach the perfection Allah has entailed for it, it's already given sacred view from its very onset.
All right.
And even in the hadith, when we are talking about abortion.
Yeah.
There is a man who goes to Imam Kadhim alayhi salam.
All right.
And he tells him, if a woman, out of fear of pregnancy and in order to get rid of her pregnancy, takes some medicine, the Imam says it's not allowed. So this narrator, who's one of the companions of Imam Kadhim alayhi salam, his name is Ishaq bin Ammar.
All right.
He says, but the baby has not come to a nutfa, it's not yet completely become a fetus as such.
Yeah.
It's like, but the first thing that's created is the fetus. So this in itself is referring to the viability of the fetus.
All right.
Therefore, if a fetus has the viability of becoming a proper human being, it's not allowed to be aborted in cases where it is safe and there is no consequences for the child or the mother. Other aspects of abortion, such as in cases of rape, baby is not fully deformed, or other issues, those have their own set of rules. Islam
Mix
does not plug everything into one absolute rule.
All right, we'll talk more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIV English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
This is Muslim Lady. I'm with Sadiqa and we are discussing abortion. Yes, you were telling us the narration by Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, wherein he tells a man that abortion is not allowed.
Exactly. And we also have a lot of the verses of the Quran that talk about the sacredness of a human. And these can, to an extent, be applied on the fetus as well. Like the Quran talks about, وَلَا تَقْتُلُوا أَوْلَادُكُمْ مِنْ أَمْلَاقِ نَحْنُ نَرْزُقُكُمْ وَإِيَّاهُمْ. Do not kill your children out of fear of poverty.
All right. Because we are the ones who give you wealth at the end of the day.
I'm the sustainer. Yeah.
Yes. Allah is the absolute sustainer. We have to struggle. And I understand that there are a lot of issues, especially with single mothers. And I can understand that they have their own struggles. Those would require to be looked at case by case. And I cannot sit here and give an absolute view on those cases, where, because single mothers do go through a lot of difficult times when bringing children into the world. And given that there's so less support for them in today's world, where to an extent we do live in a misogynistic world, where exactly. Women are often left to deal with the consequences of men's actions.
I mean, if you do not have a robotic life, you're not going to deal with it. You're not able to cope with the economic crisis going on around.
Exactly. So therefore, there is a need. So even in Islam, when it comes to single mothers, since we've just touched on the topic of single mothers, Islam still makes it mandatory on the father to provide for the child. I understand that it's not something that's practiced today so much, but when we're looking within an Islamic framework,
it's not a duty of a mother alone.
Yeah, it's not the duty of the mother to feed the child at all, apart from the milk.
All right.
The absolute duty of feeding, clothing, and everything falls on the father. It is unfortunate that today this is not practiced, and which is why we have so many problems arising.
All right. So but since we are not applying the rules of Islam in our lives, does not mean that Islam does not have those set of rules for us.
Exactly. Those rules are present. And in some cases, it has happened where the jurist forces the father to pay for the child. So yes, those, and then we also have other verses of the Quran that talk about killing of children. Like you have another verse of the Quran where the child on the Day of Judgment will say, "For what sin was I killed?"
Okay, he will be asking you.
Yes, the child will come forward and ask, "For what sin was I killed?" Now, this was revealed in Mecca when the men used to bury their daughters alive. But we can still apply it, especially when a child has the soul already blown into them and they're considered a proper being in Islam's eyes. Therefore, this would still apply to them, where they would come forward and question, "For what sin was I killed?" Because at the end of the day, the child being born out of two adults' consensual relationship is not the fault of the child.
Thank you so much, Sadiqa, for coming and explaining this topic to us in the light of verses and narrations. Inshallah, we'll discuss more on that in another session. In case you have any questions for us, you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Who is the loved one?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah, Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men, and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement has criticized Zionist regime's crimes against innocent Palestinian prisoners, saying that the martyrdom of some prisoners in jail reflects the policy of lingering killing of detainees in Israeli prisons. Palestinian detainees have endlessly resorted to open-ended hunger strikes in an attempt to express outrage at their illegal administrative detention. Zionist regime jails authorities keep Palestinian prisoners under dire conditions without proper hygienic and health standards. Palestinian inmates have also been subject to systematic torture, harassment, and repression. Human rights organizations say the Zionist regime violates all the rights and freedoms granted to Palestinian prisoners by the Fourth Geneva Convention. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media to shed more light on the issue. Stay with us to hear more about the story. The website of Middle East Eye has published an article concerning this issue, saying Palestinian groups have charged Israeli regime with medical negligence that led to the martyrdom of prisoner Musa Harun Abu Mohammed on Saturday, September 3rd. According to the Palestinian Prisoners Club, PPC, the 40-year-old was detained 2 months ago while attempting to enter the city of Al-Quds from the occupied West Bank for work. Israeli forces claimed he did not have a permit to work in Al-Quds at the time. His family said he was suffering from a neurological disorder before his arrest and that his condition deteriorated in jail. He was transferred to Asaf Hurweh Hospital at the beginning of August. The PPC said that Israeli authorities informed the family of Abu Mohammed that his body would be handed back for burial later on Saturday, September 3rd. The PPC noted in a statement Abu Mohammed was subjected to the crime of deliberate medical negligence. Abu Mohammed's martyrdom comes days after some 1,000 Palestinian prisoners suspended their hunger strike after Israeli prison authorities accepted to their demands to reverse harsh measures imposed across prisons for months. The strike was part of a series of escalating steps the prisoners had adopted since February amid the Israeli refusal to respond to their demands to reverse measures taken against them following the escape of 6 prisoners from the Gilboa prison in September last year. Palestinian rights groups charged Israeli prison services of adopting a systematic policy of deliberate medical negligence against Palestinian detainees. Palestinian Center for Human Rights website, pchrgaza.org, wrote, Abu Mohammed's martyrdom sheds the light on the general deterioration of Palestinian detainees' conditions in the Israeli jails, as there are 7,000 Palestinians, including 175 children and 32 women, detained in 23 prisons and detention facilities inside the occupied territories, in inhuman and cruel conditions that lack the standard minimum rules of the treatment of prisoners and detainees in detention. Among the detainees, there are 600 ill detainees. Some of them suffer chronic and serious diseases. According to the Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs, 231 security detainees have attained martyrdom in the Israeli prisons, including dozens who have martyred due to medical negligence policy since 1967. PCHR hereby holds the Israeli occupation authorities fully responsible for the martyrdom of Palestinian detainee Mohammed, who is the fourth detainee attained martyrdom in Israeli jails since the beginning of 2022, and for the lives of hundreds of ill detainees who would face the same fate if the policy of deliberate medical negligence continued, especially under the unhealthy imprisonment conditions where prisoners are denied adequate health care. Similarly, the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, PCHR, said, calls for a prompt and impartial investigation into Mohammed's martyrdom circumstances are needed. It also calls upon the International Committee of Red Crescent, ICRC, to intensify and ensure efficacy of their follow-up of the conditions of Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails and their imprisonment conditions. Also, it calls upon the international community to compel Israel to respect the rules of the international law and international humanitarian law, in particular the Fourth Geneva Convention and the UN standard minimum rules for the treatment of prisoners. Moreover, SaveTheChildren.org said, children in the Israeli military detention system face inhumane treatment such as beatings, strip searches, psychological abuse, weeks in solitary confinement, and being denied access to a lawyer during interrogations. The charity Save the Children consulted more than 470 children from across the West Bank who have been detained over the past 10 years. It found that most children were taken from their homes at night, blindfolded with their hands painfully bound behind their backs. Many of the respondents said they were not told why they were being arrested or where they were being taken. Every year, hundreds of Palestinian children are detained by Israeli authorities. They are the only children in the world who are systematically prosecuted through military rather than civilian courts. The most common charge is throwing stones, for which the maximum sentence is 20 years in prison. After this arrest, children are transferred to interrogation centers where they report being forced to lie face down on the metal floor of military vehicles, denied bathroom breaks, deprived of food and water, and physically assaulted. Children described the detention experience as torturous, dehumanizing, humiliating, and terrifying. Save the Children's consultation showed that 81% endured physical beatings and 89% suffered verbal abuse. 52% were threatened with harm to their families. 86% were subjected to strip searches, leaving them humiliated and ashamed. 88% did not receive adequate and timely health care, even when explicitly requested, and almost half, 47%, were denied contact with a lawyer. Save the Children asked the Zionist regime to respect international law and to end the detention and mistreatment of the innocent children and other Palestinian detainees under military law. Israeli authorities must immediately adopt practical safeguards to improve the situation for children who are currently detained. This includes ending the systematic ill-treatment of children, establishing protection and safeguards for detainees, and providing adequate services to support girls and boys to recover from their experiences. Meanwhile, a Palestinian Commission for Prisoners says that the number of Palestinian prisoners held under Israel's so-called administrative detention has increased to 700. The Palestinian Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs said in a statement recently that the reason for the surge is that Israel has intensified its administrative detention orders in recent months, particularly in occupied East Al-Quds. The commission further noted that the Palestinian administrative detainees often resort to hunger strikes to secure their release from prison, adding that some inmates have gone on hunger strike for more than 150 days before securing their freedom. More than 7,000 Palestinian prisoners are currently held in about 23 Israeli jails. Hundreds of detainees, including women and minors, are being held under administrative detention. Rights groups describe Israel's use of the detention system as a bankrupt tactic and have long called on Israel to end its use. Under the administrative detention, Israel keeps Palestinians without charge for up to 6 months, a period that can be extended an infinite number of times. The detention takes place on orders from a military commander and on the basis of what the Israeli regime describes as secret evidence. Some prisoners have been held in administrative detention for up to 11 years.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.